Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today I'm on the road in El Cajon, talking with Ben Colasso, the president of the East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce, and we're speaking about a very serious subject, which is the uprisings across Iraq. Ben, welcome to the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, as we're taping this on Wednesday afternoon, we're hearing that the city of Mosul is in the hands of terrorists, a group that is considered by some to be worse than Al-Qaeda. Tikrit is also under siege, and there are terrorist attacks going on in a number of other cities, some of them close to Baghdad. Hundreds of thousands of people are fleeing for their lives, prompting a humanitarian crisis. Ben, this has to be a tremendous concern to people here in El Cajon, where we have tens of thousands of Iraqi immigrants. What's the latest that you are hearing from your sources here and in Iraq?
The latest that we've been hearing from community members who have contacted us was that about 300,000 people fled the city of Mosul and neighboring cities for fear. I think that they are not being protected by the local government, as well as that was supposed to be posted Iraqi military protecting them. So it's kind of chaotic and barbaric at the same time. There have been quite a few murders and kidnappings already. I think what's interesting and what we just found out today was that there was $250 million that was seized from various banks in and around that area. So I think that makes the ISIL the wealthiest terrorist group, and the ISIL stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. So they stole $250 million, and wow. That's scary and really eye-opening, and I think we need to be paying close attention to that.
That is a very terrifying thought. And there's also the concern that the Iraqi police, the security forces who were trained to protect the Iraqis, seem to have fled their posts and simply let this happen.
Yeah, I think moreover, what we were hearing from people from different contacts that we have back in Iraq, they said that the lieutenants, captains, and generals who were manning the post fled before even shots were fired. So that raises some eyebrows and is skeptical. A lot of people are saying that this was maybe intended by the government and was a bigger plan. But, you know, whether it was or it wasn't, people should stand up and they should unite against this sort of thing. You know, there's a lot of collateral damage. There's a lot of civilians caught in the crossfire and fleeing their homes.
Now, Ben, do you still have family over there? Is this affecting you directly?
No, we don't have any family, but we do maintain a lot of relationship with political officials and mainly like family leaders. You know, we have quite a few of those back home. So it's chaotic. It would be like, to put in perspective for the listeners, it would be like La Mesa, Santee, and El Cajon all evacuating in one day. I mean, just kind of imagine what that would be like to happen. I mean, we can't fathom that here, but we read about it, and I just kind of want to put it in perspective for listeners.
It is truly mind-boggling. This must be very difficult for the Iraqi Chaldeans here in our community, or for that matter, the many other Iraqis who are not Chaldeans here. Ben, what are you hearing from them?
Definitely there's a lot of concern for the lives that are there, for also the investments that are there. A lot of Chaldeans that are here own property and businesses. So, and you can see some of the pictures by just doing a simple Google search or YouTube search, and you'll see the deterioration of infrastructure, looting, car bombings, fires, and what have you. So the uncertainty is there.
Right. Now, this has all occurred, of course, after the U.S. withdrawal of troops. And now the government of Iraq is pleading for help on the international stage. What is the answer here? Ben, what, if anything, do you believe that the global community should do in response?
I think more so not the international community, but the international moderate Muslims internationally within the community here and in the community in the Middle East and in Iraq, I think that moderate Muslims are the key to either call this for what it is and put a stop to it. They need to voice their distaste, disapproval, join together. I mean, we're not hearing any of their voices. All we hear about when we hear about Islamist extremist groups that take over cities or engage in violent activities, and we don't hear anything from the moderate Muslim groups. I mean, I would think that out of the total population of Muslims throughout the world, and specifically in the Middle East, there are more moderate Muslims than extremists, and that would indicate that. I mean, and that's what extremists mean. It means on the bell curve of different sides. So they need to step up to the plate and step up and fight for their country and for common sense, and not sit on a boat and throw the oars and just go with the waves. They need to grab this by the horns and handle it immediately.
Very important thoughts, Ben. Thank you for sharing that with us. And for those readers who may not be familiar with the Chaldeans, they are Iraqi Christians who trace their heritage back to the ancient Babylonians in Mesopotamia, the cradle of civilization. Now, Ben, we also have one of our interns here, Jaden Jimenez from High Tech High School. And, Ben, Jaden has been doing some research on this issue and has a question that he would like to ask.
Hi, Ben. So I wanted to ask if you knew what's happening around the neighboring countries, how it's impacting them, being that there's so many evacuations going on. So there's people being pushed into these neighboring countries, such as Syria, Turkey, et cetera.
So what we've been hearing is that, and this is... Everybody has their own theory about what happened, because the idea that Mosul could be taken over in 24 hours is something that was illogical for most people. So one theory about what we've been hearing is that the opposition group to Bashar al-Assad was responsible for getting this terrorist group, ISIL, over into Iraq, and that way they can sit back and say, look, America, we told you guys we needed help, and not just militarily. So that's what we've been hearing. So that way they cause so much chaos in the region that the United States can't help but intervene.
Interesting. So it's the opposition to Bashar Assad, the Syrian dictator, that could be behind this. We're also hearing that there is a massive flow of refugees into places like Kurdistan. Are you hearing anything from Kurdish Americans here in East County? Any updates on the situation there that they're getting from their friends and relatives back in Kurdistan?
Yeah, the Kurdish government and the Kurdistan regional government has opened their doors to a lot of people fleeing their homes and spilling over into Kurdistan. That's the extent of it. I think it's a little bit too premature how long that they're going to be there for and exactly. I mean, I think everybody's at a point now and they're asking themselves, okay, what now? So if they're at Kurdistan spilling over, or they're spilling over, they wouldn't be spilling over into Syria, that's for sure, because it is just as chaotic, or if not more, in Syria than it is in Mosul. But I think they're just going to be scattered everywhere and anywhere. We've been hearing that Tikrit has also been affected by this and has been taken over. So,
yes.
And that also raises a lot of suspicion at the very least. It raises a lot of questions, because this militant group is Sunni, and Tikrit is a predominantly Sunni area. So that's why I think a lot of theories are starting to come out, whether or not this was orchestrated by the opposition against Bashar al-Assad or orchestrated by the Iraqi government. It's kind of too premature, and we don't have that sort of intelligence on the ground to know. But everybody, it's interesting at the very least to take into consideration all the different theories, and we can kind of, you know, pencil them out on paper over here.
Now, there are also implications for Turkey in Mosul. 80 Turkish citizens have been taken hostage, Reuters News Service is reporting, and the Turkish government is warning that there will be serious ramifications if any of them are harmed. Retaliation against the militants. On Wednesday, we were seeing the ambassadors of the NATO alliance holding an emergency meeting in Brussels at Turkey's request, and who knows what's going to come out of that.
Well, I think rightfully so. People have to respect the engagements of when you have an embassy or if you have a consulate in different countries. So if they were harmed in any way, then it's the way the rules are of engagement are written and things like that. But I mean, that also, I think, amplifies that theory to get Turkey involved. And there's another unstable country that people talk about now, sort of like out of the side of their mouth. You know, what do we do about Turkey? But the whole Middle East, I mean, Turkey has been involved in various planes being shot down and denying whether airspace belongs to whom. So it's also obviously not a stable region in the geopolitically a player in that region. So I wouldn't be surprised if this was somehow orchestrated, and I don't want to come off as sounding like a conspiracy theorist, but just sort of try to imagine to the listeners out there, and I said this before, but I want to say this again, an area the size of, let's say, La Mesa, Santee, and El Cajon, and just being taken over by one day.
Yeah, it is astounding. And here's a figure to keep in mind. Ben, earlier you said 350,000 people evacuated from Mosul. The latest word just in from Reuters is it's now 500,000 people fleeing for their lives in the city of Mosul alone, and of course, other cities' evacuations going on. To put that in perspective, during the 2007 wildfires here in San Diego County, we had 500,000 people evacuate. And at the time, they said that that was the largest evacuation in world history ever for any natural disaster. That's what's going on across Iraq.
Yeah, and I mean, it's quite different. That mass evacuation was natural, and this is now man-made and horrific and barbaric and nasty. People are fleeing because they're afraid that they're going to die by being murdered and slaughtered, and rather than a fire. I just think it's that danger, and yeah, putting it in a perspective, that's more real.
It must be absolutely terrifying for the people left over there.
Indeed.
Ben, do you have any closing thoughts on this for our listeners on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice?
You know, just being the president of the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce, Mosul is the Nineveh Plains of ancient times. So this hits home with a lot of Chaldeans, obviously, who feel sad about what's happening, and they see their ancestry lands and artifacts and or infrastructure being torn. But again, I want to speak and plead with the moderate Muslims in the communities everywhere that the ball's in your court. I mean, there's very little we can do here, living in the United States, but there are a lot of ties and family ties and friendship ties. But I think what needs to bring us together is not theology or ideology, but more so a commonality that we're all Iraqis. And who wants to watch their own country burn into ruins by some ludicrous bunch of probably illiterate militants? It's a shame. It's embarrassing. It's a genocide, and we won't stand for it.
Ben, thank you very much for sharing that call for peace. We've been speaking with Ben Colasso, the president of the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce here in San Diego's East County. Ben, thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Judge Rolf True of the L.A. Superior Court delivered his ruling this Tuesday, June 10th, on the highly controversial Vergara v. California trial, which sought to determine the constitutionality of statutes which grant teachers tenure, complicate the teacher layoff process, and value seniority over skill when determining which teachers must be laid off. True ruled these statutes unconstitutional, stating that evidence has been elicited in this trial to the specific effect of grossly ineffective teachers on students. The evidence is compelling. Indeed, it shocks the conscience. The plaintiffs were 9 California students. Their legal battle was funded by Silicon Valley executive David Welch. In opposition was the state of California and 2 teachers' unions, the Teachers Federation of California and the California Teachers Association. The first witness called to the stand during the 8-week trial was John Deist, the superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District. He said Tuesday after the ruling that "This is a truly historic day for our education system. Today's decision is a call to action to begin implementing, without delay, the solutions that help address the problems highlighted in the Vergara trial. Every day that these laws remain in effect is an opportunity denied. It's unacceptable and a violation of our education system's sacred pact with the public." Jim Finberg, the lawyer who represented the teachers' unions in the trial, is confident that the evidence is on their side. His party plans on appealing the decision when it is finalized next month. "I don't think this opinion reflects the substantial evidence presented at trial," he said. "We believe the statutes do work well and serve an important government interest. In the past, the San Diego Unified School District, one of the top-performing urban school districts in the state, has rejected attempts to do away with tenure and protections for experienced teachers. San Diego's schools have flourished under this system. Once union statutes that protect teachers are done away with, each school district will be allowed to make its own guidelines concerning tenure and teacher layoffs. Because of San Diego's consistent and momentous success under the union system, it is unlikely that regulations for San Diego school teachers will change as a result of the Vergara trial." This is Trevor Hill with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Raising the national minimum wage would affect millions of workers all over the country, but would it hurt or help the economy? During the recent years, minimum wage workers, labor, and support groups have come in favor of the idea of raising the wage to help poor individuals who live off what they say is an inadequate salary. However, some business interests and fiscal conservatives have voiced opposition. Everything from protests to walkouts has been done to convince corporations and the government to raise the minimum wage to a living standard. As stated on www.raisetheminimumwage.org, with the worst recession in a generation still being felt across the nation, state and federal leaders are focused on getting their economies moving, again, while helping working families make ends meet. In direct response to these protests, as well as economic difficulties, many states and cities have opted to increase their minimum wage to an amount higher than that required by the federal government. Many who oppose a federally imposed minimum wage increase are in favor of states and cities adopting their own minimum wages. They believe that states should decide their own wages based on their specific economies and markets. They have voiced that there is not a single wage that could fit the plethora of cities in the U.S. What works in Los Angeles may not work in Birmingham, for example. Moreover, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that President Obama's proposed $10.10 wage, once fully implemented, would result in layoffs and reduce total employment by 500,000 workers. The estimate states the higher the pay, the less likely businesses will be able to or wanting to hire new employees, or even keep current ones. But on the flip side, 16 million workers are projected to keep their jobs with the pay increase. By increasing workers' take-home pay, families gain both financial security and an increased ability to purchase goods and services, thus creating jobs for other Americans, concluded the left-leaning Washington, D.C.-based think tank, Economic Policy Institute. So presumably, in the end, this would help stimulate the economy in later years. Some believe that a lot of minimum wage workers are in their teens, but there is a large majority of minimum wage workers who are out of their teens and are still working for the same pay. In 2011, 3.8 million American workers earned the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour or less, according to the estimates by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. An employee working a 40-hour week at the federal minimum wage would earn $15,080 a year. This income would leave a two-person household just under the federal poverty threshold of $15,130. But about 70% of minimum wage workers, however, work fewer than 35 hours per week, thus earning less, according to the federal labor statistics. Some might say the biggest reason for this federal increase is to help people by providing living wages and hopefully lift people out of poverty. But in a post by David Henderson, cited by the chairman of Harvard Economics Department, points out that a lot of minimum wage earners are second or third job holders in the households with other income. That could include a teenage summer employee whose parents both have jobs. Other minimum wage workers may include retirees with income from savings and Social Security who own their homes mortgage-free. This would skew the idea that raising the wage would lift people barely hanging on out of poverty. Even with the studies showing the downsides of a minimum wage increase, there's evidence of how a city handles with an increase. San Francisco, according to the new data from payroll processor Paychex and research firm IHS, says that San Francisco's small businesses are growing faster than those of any other large U.S. city and even the nation as a whole. This is happening in spite of the argument that raising the wage would put mom-and-pop operations out of business. Following the success of San Francisco, California as a whole had decided in September of 2013 to raise the state minimum wage to $10 by 2016, which then would be the highest of any state in the nation. But San Diego recently has had a debate whether to raise the city's wage to $13.09, following the idea that different wages should be appropriate for the specific economy. In a letter released by 75 economists, they voiced support for the federal minimum wage hike and say it will be good for the economy. The Economist wrote in the letter that the weight of evidence now shows that increases in the wage have had little or no negative effect on the employment of minimum wage workers. The group also wrote that this would stimulate the economy. If lawmakers were to raise the wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour nationally, the economy would grow by $22 billion in the initial phase-in period, according to the recent study by the Economic Policy Institute. When low-income households earn more money, they are likely to spend it, pouring more dollars into the economy, the argument goes. To support this, a recent study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago concluded that an increase in the wage, spendings by household with at least one minimum wage worker, increased by $700 per quarter. If you'd like more information on the debate in San Diego, visit our site for a link to UT San Diego reporting on the issue. This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 Descanso.
If your blood type is O positive, the San Diego Blood Bank wants your blood. The blood bank announced this week that it has a shortage of O positive, the universal donor blood type, which is the only blood that can safely be given to trauma patients when there is no time to test for blood type. O negative donors are urgently needed to give blood immediately at San Diego Blood Bank donor centers and blood mobiles, said Jackie Vella of the blood bank. The shortage is being caused by a patient suffering severe trauma and low donor turnout over the last few weeks, she added. To find out the location of a blood mobile or a blood bank donor center near you, you can visit sandiegobloodbank.org or call 800-469-7322. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A married couple who are San Diego police officers were arrested on Thursday, June 5th during a drug bust. The San Diego Sheriff's Department busted the duo before noon in East County and Forest Ranch. The Sheriff's Department said Bryce Charpentier, 32, and his wife, Jennifer, 41, stemmed from a long-running task force investigation. Both were arrested without incident on suspicion of conspiracy in sales, possession, and transportation of a controlled substance. Bryce Charpentier was also expected to face a charge of being under the influence while in possession of a loaded firearm, sheriff's officials said. Bryce Charpentier is a 6-year member of the department who works out of the Mid-City Division. Jennifer Charpentier has been with the agency for 18 years and is assigned to the Western Division. The Sheriff's Department stated the officers' alleged involvement in the crimes came to light within the past few days. San Diego Police Chief Shelley Zimmerman was notified and briefed by Sheriff Bill Gore, who said the San Diego Police Department is fully cooperating with the investigation. In a statement, the police department said that upon being notified of their arrests, Zimmerman placed both suspects on leave and revoked their police powers. The San Diego Police Department has been struck with several officer misconduct cases since earlier this year, including ones involving alleged domestic violence and alleged sexual assaults against female suspects. Sheriff's spokeswoman Jan Caldwell told reporters that though the arrests stemmed from a long-running task force investigation, the Charpentiers were not identified as suspects until the prior week. This report was brought to you by Stevon Marshall, and this has been Trevor Hill with East County Magazine on KNSJ.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jane Jimenez with today's Green Scene Report. For the first time ever, San Diego State University is hosting the California Higher Education Sustainability Conference, June 16th through the 20th. The campus will welcome nearly 1,000 attendees from all over California to share best practices and lessons learned in implementing sustainability on campuses. The conference will be held in the newly opened Conrad Prebys Aztec Student Union, which is on track to be the first Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED, Platinum-certified student union in the California State University system. Platinum is the highest rating for green buildings in the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED rating system. This conference will bring different professionals, researchers, and experts in sustainable best practices together, said Glenn Brandenburg, Director of Facilities and Sustainability for Associated Students. It's a unique opportunity to share a wealth of information where we can all learn and progress together. The Aztec Student Union recently received the award for the Best Overall Sustainable Design at the Energy Efficiency and Sustainability Best Practice Awards in April. Sessions will highlight the wide spectrum of sustainability practices being implemented around the state, including climate action planning, food systems, green building, health and wellness, institutionalizing sustainability, social equity, and water conservation. Conference attendees will have an opportunity to see a variety of sustainability best practices in action, including a commercial-scale rainwater collection system, the largest radiant flooring system in San Diego County, and trusses made from layers of Forest Stewardship Council-certified wood. The California Higher Education Sustainability Conference is the only sustainability conference in California that brings together all three public higher education segments, University of California, California State University, and the California Community Colleges, as well as private colleges and universities both as organizers and attendees.
Students graduating from college today face an increasing burden of debt. The average undergraduate student must borrow $30,000, and for graduate students, the burden is many times worse. The high cost of tuition, even at public colleges and universities, has made college unaffordable for many students. Aiming to help students, President Barack Obama signed an executive order on Monday requiring that people paying off student loans will not have to pay more than 10% of their monthly incomes. The measure will be retroactive, extending this benefit to millions of borrowers. The president also called on Congress to pass legislation that would provide even more reforms to help students. The bill is expected to be debated in the Senate this week, but it faces significant opposition from fiscal conservatives. In his weekly address to the nation, the president said that graduation is a time for students and their families to celebrate achievements. But he added, "For many graduates, it also means feeling trapped by a whole lot of student loan debt, and we've got to do more to lift that burden." The president noted that higher education is the most sure pathway into the middle class, since the unemployment rate for workers with a bachelor's degree is just 3.3%, about half of what it is for high school graduates. And the typical graduate of a four-year college earns $15,000 more per year than someone with just a high school degree. But despite an increase in student loans available under the Obama administration, the cost of college has continued to rise. Over the past three decades, the average tuition at a public four-year college has more than tripled. The president stated, "I've heard from too many young people who are frustrated that they've done everything they were supposed to do, and now they're paying the price." A bill introduced by Senate Democrats would help young people save money by allowing them to refinance their student loans when interest rates drop, just as homeowners can refinance their homes at lower rates to reduce their payments. The president said, "We'd pay for it by closing loopholes that allow some millionaires to pay a lower tax rate than the middle class. That's the choice that your representatives in Congress will make in the coming weeks. Protect young people from crushing debt, or protect tax breaks for the millionaires. This country has always made a commitment to put a good education within reach of all who are willing to work for it. That's what's made us an economic superpower. That's what makes us special," the president concluded. "And as long as I hold this office, I'll keep fighting to give more young people the chance to earn their own piece of the American dream." This is Trevor Hill reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today I'm opening the show with an update about a story on a teenager who went missing in East County almost 5 years ago, and we were the first ones to write about the tragedy of this missing teen. 16-year-old Mickey Guidry vanished in the Anza Borrego Desert, and he's not been seen since November 26, 2009. The Jeep that he took from his family that Thanksgiving weekend to visit friends camping in Ocotillo Wells was found broken down and abandoned near Fish Creek Wash, 22 miles from the nearest highway. Its tire was worn down to the rim, and the vehicle could not be driven. Now, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has released a photo showing what Mickey might look like today, at age 20, if he made it out of that rugged terrain alive. There is good reason to believe he did, Sheriff's Search and Rescue Leader Sergeant Don Parker believes. Intensive searches in the weeks after Mickey's disappearance failed to find any sign of foul play. Cadaver dogs found no human remains. A cover from the Jeep's spare wheel well was found on a hilltop nearby, raising hopes that Mickey may have set off on foot and could have made it out alive, possibly running away. The weather was cold and rainy, so Sergeant Parker believes he took that wheel cover to shield himself from the rain. Grounded for taking a relative's motorcycle without permission and crashing it just a week before, Mickey had been told by his parents that he could not go camping with friends that fateful weekend. So he took the family Jeep anyhow, even though he had no driver's license yet, and he headed out to Ocotillo Wells. There he met up with a girl he was friends with and her family. The girl's family told authorities at the time that they gave Mickey gas money and told him to go home. That was the last time Mickey was seen alive. Mickey's wallet and ID were left in the Jeep. His cell phone has never been found, though he may have taken it with him if he set off on foot, not realizing that the phone service had been shut off by his parents as punishment for taking the Jeep. He had no food, water, or flashlight, as far as anybody knows, and he left extra clothes behind in the vehicle. Sergeant Parker has taken the search to heart. During the many months of searching for Mickey, he fell in love with Mickey's mother, Missy, and they have since gotten married. Every time we go out there, and every time we don't find him, it brings hope that he's alive, Sergeant Parker told the UT San Diego in a recent interview. Searches have been conducted by air and on the ground, on foot and with vehicles using teams of volunteer searchers. Flyers have been widely distributed. A search of morgues and hospitals in multiple counties yielded no leads. Other than that wheel cover, not a single clue to Mickey's whereabouts has ever surfaced. Mickey's mother has praised the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children for publishing the age-enhanced photo, though she thinks Mickey's face may be slimmer than in the picture since he tended to take after her in appearance. Mickey is white with sandy hair and blue eyes. When he vanished, he had metal braces on his teeth and acne on his face. He was 5'10" tall and weighed 155 pounds. He might have been wearing denim jeans, blue high-top canvas shoes, which were Iron Maiden Vans brand, and possibly a dark blue hoodie. At the time he disappeared, his mother told East County Magazine that Mickey might have wanted to return to the family's former home in Arkansas if he left voluntarily. He also mentioned to a friend that he might be headed to Los Angeles to see a brother, but Mickey doesn't have siblings. A friend and Mickey's mother both said he had no history of involvement with drugs or gangs. Other than taking the family vehicles without permission, he had not been in any major trouble. At school in San Marcos, he enjoyed ROTC courses and Future Farmers of America. He also enjoyed working with small engines, such as lawnmowers and cars. Detective Patrick Yates, who handled the initial investigation, believed that Mickey was most likely a runaway. Mickey was the last one to have control over his life, he told East County Magazine at the time. But the abandoned vehicle, found in non-drivable condition in rugged terrain 22 miles off any major roadway, raised concerns, among many others, that Mickey's plans may have gone awry. Did he meet with foul play, or succumb to the elements on that cold and rainy November night? Or did he make it out of that rugged desert terrain? And if so, did he leave voluntarily, or might he have been abducted? No one knows, but his family holds out hope that someone, somewhere, will recognize Mickey's photo, or remember something that could lead to solving one of the most intriguing missing person mysteries in San Diego's East County. You can view Mickey Guidry's photos, then, and how he may appear now, on our website at eastcountymagazine.org or at missingchildren.com. If you have any information that could help solve this case, please call the San Diego Sheriff's San Marcos Station at 760-510-5200.
Researchers at the University of California San Diego School of Medicine have, for the first time, described the sequence of early cellular responses to a high-fat diet, one that can result in obesity-induced insulin resistance and diabetes. Dr. Gerald Olefsky, Associate Dean for Scientific Affairs and Distinguished Professor of Medicine at UC San Diego, said, We've described the etymology of obesity-related diabetes. We've pinpointed the steps, the way the whole thing happens. He also added, the research is in mice, but the evidence suggests that the processes are comparable in humans, and these findings are important not just to understanding diabetes, but how better to treat it and prevent it. Diabetes is the seventh leading cause of death in the United States and a major risk factor for other life-threatening conditions, including heart disease and stroke. More than 25 million Americans have diabetes, with another 79 million Americans estimated to be pre-diabetic, According to the American Diabetes Association, diabetes is characterized by high blood sugar level, poorly regulated by either inadequate insulin production or because the cells do not respond properly to the regulating hormone. Yoon Suk Lee, PhD, a project scientist in Dr. Olufsky lab, and colleagues fed a mice a high-fat diet. They observed that large amounts of saturated fatty acids in the diet activated ANT2, a protein in fat cells that is involved in energy metabolism. Activation of ANT2 caused increased oxygen consumption, which meant less was available for the rest of the cell. This subsequently induced production of HIF-1-alpha, a protein made to send signals of distress to the immune system, causing an inflammatory response, eventually leading to an insulin resistance in the cell. The researchers suggest that inhibiting either ANT2 or HIF-1-alpha could blunt or even reverse the damaging cellular sequence. Following that, they found that mice genetically engineered to lack HIF-1-alpha in their fat cells were protected from high-fat diet-induced inflammation, insulin resistance, and elevated glucose levels. This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Federal disaster loans are now available to those who suffered property losses in the wildfires that swept through our region in May. Two disaster loan outreach centers are being set up to help residents and businesses affected by the San Diego County wildfires apply for these low-interest federal disaster loans. The disaster loan outreach centers will be open from 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. starting Tuesday, June 10th through Thursday, June 19th. The locations are the Carlsbad City Library Learning Center and the San Diego County Library in San Marcos. Loan amounts and terms are based on the applicant's financial condition. More information is available at sdcountyrecovery.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Trevor Hill.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, my very special guest is Supervisor Diane Jacob, the Chairwoman of the County Board of Supervisors. Welcome.
Thank you.
We are here to talk about the Alzheimer's Project, which is an effort that Supervisor Jacob has been spearheading along with Supervisor Dave Roberts. And I will say, I know this is important to so many people in San Diego, including me. My own father and my grandmother had this terrible disease, so it's commendable to see someone making efforts to do something about it.
Well, thank you, Miriam, and thank you for having me on the show and taking the time to talk about a disease that is reaching epidemic proportions, not just here in San Diego County, but throughout the country.
Yeah, I understand that over 60,000 residents in San Diego County have the disease. That number is expected to double by 2030, and that it's one of the highest rates in California. I'm curious why that is.
In San Diego County, we have a growing older population, which is outpacing the rest of the population. So when you look at the 60,000 people who today have Alzheimer's disease and that doubling, say, in the next 15 years, those numbers are probably low.
Wow, that's really scary. Now, your project, as I understand it, includes efforts to both improve local care for the families of patients that already have the disease, as well as looking for ways to prevent it, treat it, and hopefully someday cure it. The initiative is bringing together, I understand, health experts from the Salk Institute, UCSD, Scripps Research Institute, and the Sanford Burnham Medical Research Institute, among others. That's a pretty high-powered bunch of scientists working on this.
We have the brightest and best here in San Diego County, and before launching the Alzheimer's Project, I actually wanted to personally go out and visit and talk to the researchers, see their labs, see what they were doing. And I do believe we've got the brightest and the best here. And if there's a cure to be found, it could easily be right here in San Diego County. But unfortunately, right now, there's no cure for Alzheimer's. And one out of three seniors will die from Alzheimer's disease.
That is just horrifying. So let's hope that this project yields some positive results.
Well, also in San Diego County, it's the third leading cause of death, which is higher than in the nation. The first is heart disease and then second cancer.
Wow, that's really shocking.
Now, we have a wonderful intern, Jessica Richmond, who just graduated from San Diego State University. I really want to congratulate her. She's interned before with us, and she's back again this summer. And Jessica did some research on Alzheimer's and the project, and so she had a few additional questions that we thought we'd ask. First one, Diane, is what inspired you to take this effort to try to find some hope out there for Alzheimer's and to make it a priority?
I attended a conference out at Skyline Church last year, mm-hmm. and it was put on by the Alzheimer's Association, and I stayed for the entire conference, and I was really taken by the information that was shared about the disease. I had no idea, because it is a disease that people have not wanted to talk about. And when I heard the statistics, like third leading cause of death, 60,000 people in San Diego County have the disease, and that one out of three seniors will die of Alzheimer's. Yeah. And then I learned that this year the federal government is allocating $562 million for Alzheimer's research. Wow. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but it's nothing compared to the research money that's put into cancer or heart disease.
True.
And not to take anything from that, but the annual nationwide cost of Alzheimer's disease is $200 billion.
Wow.
So definitely we need to beef up the money for research and work aggressively to find a cure, because those numbers, that $200 billion annually nationwide, will only go up, break the bank. So Alzheimer's not only takes a devastating toll on families, but also it hits the taxpayers pretty hard, too.
Yeah, it does, and our entire healthcare system is
absolutely
driving those healthcare costs up and up and up. Is San Diego positioned to perhaps get some of those federal funds, and where will the money come from for the project, the Alzheimer's Project, Diane?
Well, the Alzheimer's Project is looking at the Alzheimer's disease both from a cure and a care standpoint, and we've convened a roundtable of the researchers from the four institutes here. We've already met, in fact, and they're very excited about partnering with the county, and their charge is to come up with some recommendations of what they need. What can the county do to partner with them to help them to find a cure for Alzheimer's? Obviously, they need more money for research, but they need people for clinical trials. And there's legislation, too, which the board has already supported. So that's on the cure side. In the meantime, with more than 60,000 people today in San Diego County living with the disease, 80% of those people are being cared for in-home.
Why is that, Diane? Is it because the space just isn't available, or is it a cost issue? What's the reason?
It's very expensive to put someone with Alzheimer's in a facility.
Yeah.
And so most people can't afford it.
Dead.
It can be $4,000, $5,000 a month easily. So, you know, so people are taking care of their loved ones at home, and if they can afford it, they'll have someone come in, respite care, or to relieve them for a little while so they get a break.
Now, is the project also looking at getting some help for the caregivers like that, perhaps more funding for in-home care or for facilities that would be residential care facilities? And also, I wonder about treatments. We don't have cures. Is there any promise out there in terms of treatments that might slow the progression of the disease or a vaccine?
Well, from the knowledge I've gained, there is nothing out there that slows the progression of the disease. And a person can live with the disease for as much as 10 years. So it's not something that you are diagnosed with the disease, you know that you're going to die, you just don't know when, and this could go on and progress, and it's not a very good prospect both for the caregivers and for the person with the disease.
So it sounds like short term, some of the focus needs to be on helping the caregivers and just getting the appropriate care for the patient and help for the families as well.
Well, that's what the caregiver group that will come together focus on. What can we do? Again, the county being the largest public health agency to partner with caregivers and come up with some recommendations of what we need to do now and then plan for the future, because this is going to be a growing problem. It's reaching epidemic proportions. So we are doing the right thing at the right time.
Now, I'm also curious,
Whether the project is going to look at all at the link between nutrition and dementia. For example, the Alzheimer's organization now advises that if people are obese late in life and they also have high cholesterol and high blood pressure, they are 6 times more likely to develop dementia. That sure got my attention, and I know I'm certainly changing my diet a little bit to reflect.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know the answer to that, but it certainly seems that diet, proper nutrition, exercise, things we already know, but a lot of people are not doing. This fits in very nicely with our Live Well program, San Diego, because it's no smoking, eat right, eat the right foods, and also exercise. Just
right.
Those three things. And that could be a lot of what we tie into having a healthy brain.
There you go. So educating the public on things like that might be part of this program.
Public education, awareness is a big part of the Alzheimer's Project. It's a disease people have not wanted to talk about it. We're talking about it. We're getting the information out there, and we'll be waging a major public education campaign partnering up with the Alzheimer's Association. And so people are aware, just like they're aware of the symptoms of stroke or symptoms of heart attack. We
Sure.
want people to know, what are the symptoms of Alzheimer's? What are the signs of Alzheimer's? And then mainly to talk about it, educate people, raise the level of awareness. So people who have it, those that are caring for people with Alzheimer's, they know they're not alone.
Very good. Now, San Diego is, of course, one of the leading regions for biomedical research. Do you think this initiative could also bring more jobs, such as in the research laboratories, over time?
Well, I think it's possible.
Caregiver jobs, that sort of thing?
Definitely. The healthcare industry is a growing industry. And we have a growing number of people that are getting older much faster than the rest of the population.
I also understand that as part of this project, there's an aging summit coming up on June 12th right here in San Diego.
Miriam, I'd like to invite all your listeners. It's on June 12th, and it'll be 8:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. It'll be at the Town and Country Convention Center, and it's free.
Now, the focus of this year's Aging Summit will be Alzheimer's.
There'll be breakout sessions. We'll have keynote speakers, Gail Sheehy, who is author of Passages and Passages for Caregivers. She was actually on the New York Times bestseller list, her books. And then Darlene Shiley, who's been a well-known local philanthropist and a former caregiver herself. The two of them will keynote the address, and there'll be breakout sessions. So people who want to come, they'll have an opportunity to learn about financial planning, disaster preparedness, and then our real focus is Alzheimer's and related dementias, and there'll be breakouts, researchers, and a lot of information on that.
Excellent. So opportunities to ask questions and get a lot of really helpful information out there.
Yes, and a free lunch and opportunity drawings.
Can't beat that. Thank you very much for joining us, Diane, and also, listeners, if you want more information about the conference or the Alzheimer's Project, for the conference you can visit alsevents.org, or you can call AARP registration line 877-926-8300.
Thank you.
And listeners, we understand that the reports from the CURE and the CARE groups researching this
will be coming back to the supervisors for a conference on December 2nd, so you may want to mark your calendars and follow up on that. And hopefully there's going to be some positive recommendations come out of that session. Supervisor Jacob, I want to thank you again for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. East County has plenty of activities to enjoy this weekend, including some designated for Father's Day. However, many of the events this weekend might be interesting for Dad and the family to enjoy. Plus, we have a major festival in El Cajon that is number one on our list. El Cajon's America on Main Street will be held on Saturday, June 14th, in downtown El Cajon from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. This event is a family-friendly community festival that celebrates the American spirit through appreciation and respect for the many diverse ethnic and historical groups in the community. Highlights include two stages with live entertainment, American and ethnic food booths, a Ferris wheel and other rides, arts, crafts, display booths, a petting zoo, rock wall, a Fiesta de Football street soccer event, and more. This patriotic event is planned to coincide with the nationally recognized Flag Day. Additionally, there will be a special red, white, and blue area saluting our military. The location is East Main Street and Rhea Avenue, between Magnolia and Claydale Avenues. James Hubbell's annual Father's Day open house includes the grand opening of the new Ilan Lael Foundation building, the first brand new building on Hubbell Hill in 10 years. Iconic San Diego artist, global humanitarian, and cultural leader James Hubbell once again invites the public to tour his family's magical and historically designated compound in Julian for the annual Father's Day open house on Sunday, June 15th. The archive and gallery spaces of the new building will be open for the first time ever, which will showcase some of Hubbell's most recent work. The Father's Day tour will be open to the public with tours from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. or 1:30 p.m. to 4 p.m. The ticket price includes shuttle service from Winola Farms Marketplace to Hubbell Hill. Engineer for an Hour at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum in Campo is a rare opportunity for a train enthusiast 18 years and older, maybe dad, to take the controls of a powerful diesel railroad locomotive and power it down the track using air brake, throttle, and horn at the 40-acre Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. This activity is normally reserved for licensed locomotive engineers only. Participants are awarded a commemorative certificate. There will be opportunities to share running time with family and friends. Online reservations are required, and it is first come, first served. The museum's historic Golden State vintage passenger trains will also make a 12-mile, one-hour scenic journey to Tunnel Number 4 and return. Reservations are not required. The museum also has a gift store, free parking, and it is wheelchair friendly. Dates for the Engineer for an Hour are this Saturday and Sunday, June 14th and 15th, and next weekend on Saturday and Sunday, June 28th and 29th, from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Two Father's Day brunch events will be held in Julian on Sunday, June 15th. Cowboy Jack Johnson will be performing solo on acoustic and electric guitar on Sunday, June 15th for a Father's Day brunch at the Pine Hills Lodge. Cowboy Jack plays country and bluegrass and roots. At times he is said to sound like Hank Williams and other times like Johnny Cash, with a little Gene Autry undercurrent to every song. He will be performing favorites from country and western music. The Pine Hills Lodge is located in Julian, and their website is www.pinehillslodge.com. Jeremy's on the Hill will be having a Father's Day brunch and specials in the Winola area just outside Julian. San Diego Ghost Hunters will be presenting a program. San Diego Ghost Hunters will be presenting a program at the El Cajon Library on East Douglas Avenue in downtown El Cajon on Saturday, June 14th from 2 to 4 p.m. So if you like reading about paranormal activity and unexplained phenomena such as clairvoyance and ghosts, you'll enjoy this free program where guests will hear true accounts and see pictures of encounters with the other side. The movie Frozen will be featured at Movies in the Park at Viejas on Friday, June 13th at 8 p.m. Movies are enjoyed at the Outlet Center under the stars in a park setting. Children 12 and under are free to attend but must be accompanied by an adult. Next week, on June 20th, The Avengers will be shown. Campo Kiwanis presents Barn Dance at the Star Ranch in Campo, featuring the Honky Tonk Kings Country Dance Band on Saturday, June 14th, from 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. A barbecue dinner will be served from 7 to 10 p.m. The event is for those adults 21 and over with ID. There will be door prizes, and all proceeds benefit Kiwanis Projects. Free Comedy Fridays are featured at the Space Bar Internet Cafe on University Avenue in La Mesa. Shows this month are on Friday, June 13th, 20th, and 27th. Tour Nature is a leisurely hike amid the scenic landscapes and historic grounds of Old Mission Dam, starting at the Kumeyaay Lake Campground in Mission Trails Regional Park on Saturday, June 14th, from 8:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. Hikers can get some fun facts as the MTRP Naturalist Guide unwraps secrets of nature during the hike. Hikers meet at the campground entry station. This hike will also be offered on Saturday, June 28th, at the same time. The Visitor Center for Mission Trails Regional Park is not far from the Kumeyaay Lake Campground, and on Saturday, June 14th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., is presenting Lizard Lifestyles, a free hands-on science program presented by MTRP Trail Guides, where guests can learn about various lizards found in the park. Guests can get the scoop on lizard lifestyles and try their skill at matching each lizard with its identity clues. After the weekend on Tuesday, the El Cajon City Council is recognizing El Cajon Crest native Jimmy Johnson, NASCAR champion, for his racing accomplishments and philanthropic contributions to the community on Tuesday, June 17th, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Centennial Plaza. El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells, the City Council, Joel Anderson, and other local dignitaries will be honoring Johnson during a special ceremony beginning promptly at 11 a.m. Special presentations are planned. To date, Johnson's foundation has given more than $6.5 million to schools here in El Cajon and across the nation. Due to Jimmy's hectic schedule and the crowds expected, this is not an autograph opportunity event. But Jimmy's number 48 show car will be on display, and special Team 48 photo cards will be available while supplies last. Now for a preview of two upcoming summer-only events soon to begin and a blues event. The City of Santee's Summer Concert Series begins June 19th with an expanded lineup featuring performances by 11 well-established regional bands. The free concerts are held Thursdays at 6:30 p.m., except for the week of July 4th holiday, at Town Center Community Park East in Santee. The live bands performing this summer include rock, country, blues, tribute bands for the Beatles and Elvis, and more. New this year, each concert will have a theme that is integrated into the entire experience, so food offered for sale will be different each concert, depending on the theme. Outdoor movies at Santee Lakes will begin on June 27th this year. The Movies by the Lake series includes games and activities for children before the movie, and of course picnicking, with lots of grass, picnic tables, and a playground nearby. The 16th annual Julian Blues Bash will be held at Mangini Winery in Julian on Saturday, June 21st. Gates open at 10 a.m. and six great blues bands will play till 7 p.m. There will be free parking and tickets are on sale at the Julian Chamber office in the Town Hall on Main Street and at www.rob-bauerpresents.com. Children 12 and under are free. That's all for this week. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is supported by our listeners and by a community enhancement grant from San Diego County. See you around, East County.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road,
A.K. Jules,
Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617.
We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.